It's Wednesday, November 20th, 2013, and welcome to episode 159 of Tech Talk for Teachers. I'm Tom Grissom.
I'm Cindy Rich.
I'm Mike Joya.
Welcome to Tech Talk for Teachers, the show about teaching and learning with technology. And first up today, I would like to mention that we're only going to have one show this month, with Thanksgiving break coming up at the end of the month. And then also we'll have one episode in December. Today, our first segment is on mobile photography, and we'll have a guest, Brian Poulter, one of the professors here at the journalism department here at EIU. We'll be talking about mobile photography and how he's using the iPhone and the new Lumia Windows phone. So we've got that up. And then, Mike, I think you're going to have a security spotlight section.
Oh, yes. Again, about Adobe.
Adobe's in the news again. Imagine that. So, and then Cindy, let's see, we're going to talk a little bit on some tech picks, and this week is one of those anniversary weeks.
It is. Major historical events. So we're going to talk a little bit about resources and how things have changed when recording history.
Okay. So here we go. With me today is Brian Poulter, a professor of journalism here at EIU, and I've invited Brian in today to talk a little bit about mobile photography. That's his specialty here in the School of Journalism. How could a teacher benefit from some of the mobile technologies, and specifically some of the photography that's so easily available today?
Okay, that's a really good question. When I think of journalism, and specifically my area, I teach photojournalism, I don't see it being that much different than being a teacher. And by the way, everybody in my family have been teachers way back to hundreds of years ago. So you don't get out of my house without thinking about how you teach people stuff. And that's essentially all that a journalist does. And there are no lawyers in my family, but that's what lawyers do. If you really think about what teaching is, it's the same thing as journalism. You take a bunch of information, you break it down into components for your audience, or in this case, students, and you figure out what's the best way to communicate this information to people in a way they want to digest it. 80% of everything people learn has a visual component to it. So for teachers, I know a lot of them have smartphones. It's a great way to just not talk about something. You can show something with it, and I don't know if we'll get too much into it today, but you can also videotape it with this cell phones. So it's just a great tool that's becoming more and more ubiquitous. Flickr, which is the sort of the Facebook of photography, the most used apparatus to create photographs on that site is the iPhone 4 and 4S right now. Cell phones, smartphones as a class, outnumber all other devices photography. We're talking the Nikons and the Canons and the SLR and all that. So clearly people are using these. They're people are very comfortable looking at photographs on them. And then I just saw a poll that said that the majority of Americans have never picked up a standard camera, that they're using smartphones.
That's getting to be more true every day because of the technology advancements and just the availability, the ubiquity of the mobile phone always having it with you.
So these teachers, I'm arguing, are probably most of them have phones. Why not use this free tool? Not free, you pay a lot for it monthly, I understand that. But this tool that you already have, it's in your pocket, and figure out how you can augment your teaching. And they are surprisingly sophisticated devices, and they take really, really great photos, as I've been finding out as I keep upgrading and finding either the software that's free, or in some cases I have to pay $2.99 for a piece of software, which still blows my mind it's that cheap.
Yes. For professional quality tools, that we were doing the $100, $200, $300 pieces of software not so long ago.
Well, and if anyone in your audience wants to go buy the top-of-the-line Canon body, they can still spend $6,500 for the camera with no lens if they want to spend that big dollars. And granted, it does something that your smartphone can't do. But I'm constantly stunned at what a smartphone can pull off.
Yeah. Now, I'll put a link in the show notes to a couple of your blogs. We had you on Tech Talk for Teachers a couple years ago, I believe. And mm-hmm. the last time you were on, you were taking a trip and going retracing the route of the Oregon Trail.
Correct.
And you've done something similar here this past summer. So we'll put a link out to the blog. But you will also, I'll try to remember to put a link out to that Flickr set that you were just showing me just a few moments ago. But I am just stunned by the quality. Now, are you doing any retouching or reprocessing of those?
Yeah. This last summer, Joe Gisondi, he's another journalism professor and I, we traveled Illinois Route 1, which is the longest state highway in Illinois, 330 miles. It starts at the southern tip of the state, Cave and Rock, Illinois, and terminates in the south side of Chicago. And we just traveled the road, and I shot with a iPhone 5 and a Nokia 928 Lumia, which Verizon lent me for the summer to work on these projects. And then previously, the previous summer before that, I did the old National Road, which is sort of US 40 from Vandalia, Illinois, the first capital, and it started in Cumberland, Maryland. And I shot that all on an iPhone 4S. And with simple apps that you can get for free and simply retouching it in some software. When I say retouching, I'm not changing reality. I'm a photojournalist, so I'm correcting color and I'm
brightness, contrast,
exposure, the same things we've been doing for 170 years in photography. And in the right conditions, it's stunning how great the photography you can generate, one can generate from these cell phone cameras. I honestly think of I'm currently shooting with an iPhone 5. I'm not rich enough or fancy enough to have the new one. And I really like the Nokia, by the way. I can see one of those in my future. But it's amazing with simple software how good the photographs you can get out of them in the right lighting conditions. Now, I know that the Chicago Sun-Times and some newspapers have foolishly decided that, oh, we can just hand cameras to reporters and iPhones and have them be great photographers. And that's simply not going to work because they don't work in all conditions. And I'm going to argue that as a photographer, you shouldn't let me write because I can do it.
Right.
But it's not my strength. It's not what I've trained for 20 years. So it's not an end-all be-all, but you can accomplish a lot.
Yeah, it's not just snapping, you know, the shutter button or whatever. What amazes me so much about the pictures is the sharpness. Are you doing anything special there on the focus?
The one you happen to have up, and if the audience goes and looks at it, it's a portrait of a African-American gentleman on his motorcycle, literally within 100 feet of where Illinois Route 1 starts. I used an app called Camera Plus. It's mm-hmm. camera with a plus sign. If you have an iPhone, you want Camera Plus. It's a great tool. If you're on a Windows, another company makes one called Camera Plus that I'm not a huge fan of. Mm-hmm. And later on in the show notes or what, I can give you a list of what I think are the best apps for the various cameras. But what is really nice about this app is you can touch the screen and it says focus there, wherever you touch the mm-hmm. screen. And you can also move where it's going to take the exposure from in the picture. So although you don't have manual control, by telling it where to take an exposure reading, you essentially have a form of manual control. Mm-hmm. And I'm dead serious when I say I wish they would put this in the $3,000 and $4,000 Canon and Nikon backs that you could touch the screen and say, hey, focus there. Hey, expose there. And that's what gives you the ability to control the sharpness. And there's a similar app available for the Nokia Windows. I think it's called Camera Pro, but I'll have to double check.
And then they just had one I was just reading a little bit about, Refocus.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of the Nokia. You know, Nokia with the 928 and the 1020, and now then they're expanding that phone line into, you know, this phablet territory is getting beyond a phone now. But this Refocus app, again, you can touch, you know, do your touch point of focus. And then the other thing, one of the recent innovations, and I think this is the first time it's happened on a mobile platform, some of the new Nokia phones are going to be shooting in RAW.
Exactly. They came out with, I believe it's the 1040 is the one you see. Yeah. I could be wrong. Yeah. What's the one on the TV commercial?
1020.
Yeah. 1020. They're coming out with a 1050, which actually has less resolution. It's only 10. But both of those through software or through the new version can shoot in RAW. And what RAW is a format that essentially doesn't apply JPEG compression and color correction and all these things. You do that after the fact.
Like anything else,
desktop or something. And it gives you great control.
Yeah. Kind of like when we do this podcast, we're recording this in a WAV format. And when you start compressing things like an MP3, you're starting to throw out that quality. So you always want to start with the best possible that you can. And then as you, you know, go through and do the edits, getting to that compromise. I'm seeing some of those picture sizes like 40 megapixel, which is huge.
And what you got to remember about that, in 40 megapixel, when it's JPEG, it's not 40 megabytes in size.
No, no.
But if you start shooting in RAW, it's 20 or 30 megabytes per picture.
Right.
And it's a lot. So that's why if I'm going to go get one, I'm going to get the 1050, which shoots 10 megapixels, but shoots it in RAW, and they'll be around 7 or 8 megabytes when they come out. I don't want a 40 megapixel uncompressed photo to deal with. I really, really don't. That's way overkill.
It's too large, and then you have to worry about all those storage issues and things on your phone. You wouldn't be able to get very many unless you had expandable storage, that you could pop in an SD card or something and take it out.
And honestly, sometimes you're taking a picture and you want to knock the size down what you can under preferences because you're just going to throw a picture up on your Facebook or your website or your WordPress or whatever, wherever you're doing it, and you don't ever intend it to go into a press or into large format.
Mm-hmm. But back to you, this is called the Long Winding Road. So this is your Illinois Route 1 trip and things. So we'll provide the link out there in the show notes. And the other piece of this, we were talking earlier about the storytelling, which you're wrapping around, brief, short, to the point, concise. But you literally are telling the story as you travel down the road. And you've got the pictures. Click out here and then to expand to go a little bit more to each one of the articles. Looking here, you have a tea party picture with a bunch of this, like a yard sale.
Yeah, it's a thrift sale.
And you've got a top-down view. So are you like on a ladder?
Actually, no. I'm just standing.
You're like 6'5", so.
Well, I'm only about 3 feet from that. Just the wide-angle lens at work there, which is a nice tool. One of the things when you shoot stuff like this is one of the things for your listeners to keep in mind is that most of these smartphones, when you zoom, you can put your finger on it and you can just a slider to zoom in and out. You're using software zoom. You're not using a real mechanical zoom. So the software is basically enlarging. What it's seeing and making up data, so to speak. And it's not as sharp if you really had a real lens that was moving there. That's most of the cell phones. Some of them actually do have a zoom in them. So I almost never zoom using my smartphone. It's wide angle. I just get closer and closer and closer, and that's how you get better and better pictures. I can imagine someone out there who's teaching science, and they want to teach something about tadpoles to frogs or something like that. And that's where this tool that they have in their pocket can be really, really helpful. I know a lot of teachers throw up web pages, and a lot of journalists put up web pages, and a lot of them are junk because they're just kind of showing off. But we documented Illinois Route 1, so that was the goal here. And so we had a clear idea of how we're going to use it, and it makes making the photographs and using them well. And I have to add, by the way, that I have my photos on this site in my short version of the stories, but my colleague Joe Gisondi wrote thousands of words in a 6-part series that ran in a newspaper, and maybe we should link to that too, because if you want to really see great word storing and the photos, he's a great
writer. It's good teaching. We're always doing those different modalities, so whether it's audio, we haven't talked about video, but the still pictures and things like that. You really do need to mix that up in your teaching to provide all those different modes of input, because different students learn different ways. And I'm finding myself more and more with the tablets and things, I'm finding myself what I call teaching on the fly. You'll come to a moment, it's kind of that teachable moment where, like you mentioned, the tadpoles or something, you'll be out and it's like, oh, I have this device, it has a camera, I can click or I can do a short little video and then bring that back in for my students, to see, kind of like a little virtual field trip type experience. But I'm finding myself using the cameras on these devices more and more because, one, the ubiquity. When it's mobile, whenever you have it on there, you're going to use it more. But I think, having said that, sometimes because it's there, we ignore it. as well. So I think you kind of have to force yourself to kind of get in that habit out there. It's like, oh, you know, I have this device on here. How could I use this for my teaching? And blogs are an excellent way because it's that reflective practice going out there. And I mean, you learn a lot, and just, you know, it's evident, you know, by looking at, you know, the professionalism of the photographs, the way that you can compose it, and teaching the same way. You know, you mentioned the Chicago, is that the Chicago Times or?
Sun-Times.
Sun-Times, they essentially dismissed their entire photography staff.
Many, right? Of whom had won Pulitzers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, top people in the world, and they handed the mobile phones to their writers.
And I think you're, in my opinion, talking about a newspaper that really is dying because of a lot of it, not because newspapers are dying, but because of bad management practices and short-sightedness. And I think for me, this might be the lid on the coffin. When you start giving away your Pulitzer Prize winning staff.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, to relate that back to teaching and things, because we're experiencing something similar. You know, all industries are kind of going through this turmoil, mm-hmm. this technology revolution that we're undergoing. But teaching is definitely both a science and an art.
Oh, yes.
And so there's a lot of similarities and things that I see there.
Well, too, it's another way to teach outside the classroom. I can imagine a teacher having a blog and they're seeing something relating to the teacher, and they grab a photo and they write a little paragraph and they put it up. We're not talking about a dissertation. We're talking about, here's an example of this. So you're walking along and you see, I don't know, a caterpillar training a butterfly. It's a way to reinforce something you're teaching. And at least until a certain point, maybe high school, students are sort of look at their teachers as godlike. I remember my daughter going to school with a thing of saran wrap because we couldn't get the saran wrap to separate, and she knew her fourth grade teacher could do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's another way to be, for them to invest in you as a teacher, is you show and demonstrate these just little mini lessons.
Right.
A photograph in five sentences can reinforce something, and you see these things and it makes it come alive.
Right. And turning that around, not just the teaching doing it, but the students also have these mobile devices and things. So turning that around for those assignments for the students themselves to go out and experiment and internalize that. Again, you know, we learn best by doing things. So certainly get that out in the hands of the students.
And there's all kinds of ways to set up a website where people can submit work, but you have to okay it. So a student says, oh, look, I found this. And it's that you're getting this circle of education where you're talking to them and they're talking back to you. And it's all because you have a different way of expressing the lesson, which is a visual component. And we know they're online, so let's see if we can't snag them now and then.
Mm-hmm. And philosophically, I don't know, do we know something when we see it, or do we see it when we know it? You know, kind of that little philosophical argument. And I kind of go both ways depending upon the situation. But, you know, our minds, you know, we learn what we attend to. And we can be looking something plain as day, and I'll just tell just a quick little vignette here. Next time you see a FedEx truck, see if you can see the arrow in the FedEx logo.
And I bring this up with students, and some have gone, oh, I knew it was there all the other time, and I show other ones the arrow in the FedEx logo, and they go, I never saw that. Or I actually know people that don't know that the bent L and staple is a bent staple, and you know, the Staples logo,
uh-huh.
They don't see that at all.
Yep.
Or the old Big Ten logo. Type in old Big Ten logo. It has the number of 11 stuck, yep. in the middle of it because
mm-hmm.
there were 11 teams in the conference, and that was actually designed by an Eastern Illinois University art professor.
I didn't know that.
So it's another way for people to look at something. I know from magazine and newspaper design that they're one of the things I can really argue why students need to be aware of how to visually communicate with their audience is that when a person looks at a magazine or a newspaper, they look at the photo, then they read the caption, then they read headlines, then they read the stories. The photo or the graphic or the graph or the map is the entry point often on a page. And if you can bring the power of the real visual image to your teaching through something you did on your cell phone, it's just another way of hitting them.
Mm-hmm.
And we know visually it's where they're going to be looking first anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine going to Facebook and there are no pictures on it. Nobody's going to Facebook anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we could go on and on here, but for sure I will put some links out in the show notes to the blog. The most recent trip going down Illinois Route 1, so be sure to check those out. We'll provide a link out there for some of those Flickr sets. And you mentioned that you had sets, so you have sets for, like you mentioned, the iPhone, and then I think you had a different set for the...
I have one set for Illinois Route 1 that's
your mixture.
Nokia and the iPhone,
okay.
5, and then the other one's all iPhone 4S. That just happened to be what I had.
Yeah. Well, any last thoughts here for the teachers out there?
You just got to start playing with it and using it. And one of my favorite things to just do is go for walks and try to make photos to supplement my teaching. What was I trying to teach today, and how do I visually represent that? Yeah. And I think we can also, I can throw up a quick list of recommended apps by Android, iPhone, or the Windows operating system.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
No problem.
Today we have another Security Spotlight segment, and I guess that means we're going to be talking about Adobe again, Mike.
Of course. I mean, that's the most interesting thing that happened.
Third time's a charm.
It shows that just how integrated Adobe, a program, is in our lives. And I was reading online today that you think of Adobe, you think of like creative software mm-hmm. packages, mm-hmm. developing web pages and stuff. But the fact with their breach and the high number of their breaches, there's a issue that they call it the hack around the world, because now mm-hmm. they're saying there's over 200,000 federal government websites that could be compromised, or not websites, but employees' accounts that could be compromised because people have the bad security habit of using the same password mm-hmm. for right. multiple accounts.
Right. Right. So it's so, rippling effect through all these different
right.
accounts.
And there were some other security aspects that how Adobe was storing the encrypted passwords wasn't by what they call hash, but by asymmetric encryption. So it's a single key for all the encryption for all those passwords. And
so once you break it, you have everything.
Right. So once someone breaks that password, and I've heard Anonymous is on the hunt for that because of all the government websites they could gain access to, or mm-hmm. accounts they could gain access to. So program software, it's just software, a company that's just software, is now affecting multiple, hundreds of thousands of people.
It's certainly worldwide now.
Right. Especially with all the source code and everything that they
got. But it's like we expect things like that with banking or finance or communications things, and this is unique
right.
in that it's
yeah.
not.
And people just don't realize that, a PDF is Adobe. For the
right.
most part.
Right.
So
every restaurant menu you open, everything like that you use
right.
online.
Right. You could have an account tied to that.
Right.
And,
yeah.
and then the hacker got them all.
Well, yeah, it's just expanded. I mean, we probably back up a little bit. I think 2-3 months ago we talked, there were originally reported 2.9 million accounts.
Right.
Then the next time we had our podcast a month later, it was like 38 million.
Yeah, now it's like 150 million.
Yeah, kind of what I've heard.
Plus the 200,000 other accounts, just government accounts that's tied to you. I'm sure there's just millions of other accounts that someone could have access to based off of that single
yeah.
password of that individual that was found. I read another article, and I'm sitting here going, just kind of, shaking my head when it happened, is if they had what they call two-factor authentication, this wouldn't have happened because,
yeah.
You would have the passwords, but you still need that extra piece of authentication to even get into the account.
Yeah. Now, back up a minute and explain what the two-factor
was.
That's the three-factor, I guess.
Yeah. There is like three different stages of multi-factor authentication. Two-factor means you have two parts of the three stages. Like passwords is something that you know.
Uh-huh.
Something that you have could be something like a card that has a special chip that you slide in that is an extra. And then the third one is more of what we call biometric security, like something that's unique.
Something that's on you or
right.
part of you.
So like all Apple phones, if you have a passcode and the new 5S with the fingerprint scanner, that's two-factor authentication because you would have to imitate someone's fingerprint, and then you would have to know someone's passcode.
Right.
So it's something you know and something you have.
Or the more common one that I deal with all the time is punching in your phone number for a text for them to send a code back whenever you change a password.
Right. Well, and technically, a passcode isn't two-factor authentication. It's not multi because, again, it's just some things that you know. You know a password
right.
and number sequence, so that's two things that you know.
Right.
Right. But you're always talking about the layers of security,
right.
and the more layers that we can put there, the better.
One financial thing that I've gone through and that has, you put in a login and a password, and then it asks you a question, and you answer, and then it has an image that should always be the same image, and you put another
pin
under that, or password under that, right? And so, but there's three steps that you go through, right. But
that was the other thing I was reading about with the Adobe. They're talking about also some of the security questions were leaked, weren't they? Some of
yes, it has the security questions as part of it, was part of the password.
And I mean, I've been just seeing, you know, because I'm kind of paying attention since we talk about this on the show and things. So I just kind of see various news articles. I saw where they're making like a crossword puzzle out of the most common passwords. Did you see
that? I'm sure. I'm sure. It's just amazing to me that how common people are just like, just because it's inconvenient, they're like, I can't.
And the most common password was, I think, 123456.
I'm sure.
You know, and all those other things that we've talked about, you know, previously on this show and things. But yet, you know, it's still very common out there.
And, you know, it's interesting. I read another article about passwords and how a person in my field, in the security field, on his spare time as a hobby, he works on cracking passwords, and he's come up with special amounts of dictionaries that isn't just based off of like words and sequences from a dictionary, but if he knows someone's like a major in biology or right. is in the biology field, he'll use certain dictionary sets of specific stuff for like bio. Mm-hmm. And he said, you wouldn't believe how fast you can crack passwords mm-hmm. by having these type of custom mm-hmm. dictionaries just by knowing one piece of fact off of someone, which is pretty easy to find. Right. Yeah. Very, you think wouldn't be.
Well, with all the social media, Facebook and everything else, you know, it just takes one little clue out
pet
there.
Pet names are very common. Yeah. Someone mm-hmm. knows your pet names, you know, that's, I mean, I bet
well,
you guys have a password that's a pet name.
But we see, not me.
I don't. Uh-huh.
But uh-huh. we yeah.
I don't, really, seriously, I don't.
She has 1, 2, 3, 4.
No, I don't. I could quickly, you would get mine just like that when I told you a little hint, though, it's mm-hmm, because it is an obvious.
I have an algorithm
that
only I know, which can get me in trouble sometimes because, I don't know, I change it periodically, but, you know, it's this problem. As you get older, mm-hmm. you tend to forget things. You also go through different, like I said, algorithms and things. It's like, okay, which one do I want to use this time? And, you know, the more consequence I would have if somebody got something, I guess it's more complex. I make it, you know, harder.
Right.
But it's tough when you give the advice that you have to have a different username or a different password for, I don't know, I've mm-hmm. lost count how many accounts. You know, anything you sign up today online, you've got to have an account and password. Just reading news articles and things, you know, going to like, you know, The Chronicle or eWeek mm-hmm. or any of those, sign in here to read the rest of the article.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, maybe because I'm a security nerd, but when I'm starting a new account and it has you fill out your password the first time, some have like the strength meters on it. I'm always trying to like
max
it out.
Yeah.
You want an 18 character password? Of course I do.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess kind of moral of the story, and we have this here at Eastern anyway, is the importance to periodically change that password.
Yes.
And just not just to let it sit out there, from, you know, going on years and years, which some people do.
And it's the common things. Change your password, you know, regularly, you know, twice a year is pretty common. Once a quarter maybe is even better. Once a month's great. If you have that many passwords, you can cycle through. And then, you know, if you have to do security questions, make sure it's something that you only know, and don't make it easy for them. You know, like pet's name. You know, right. That's not very.
And do not write it on a piece of paper and stick it on.
Common. Don't respond to phishing emails. You know, don't respond to people asking for your password. And don't click rogue links in emails. You know, you didn't win the lottery in Africa.
Right.
It's the same common things over and over again.
Now, we should mention, because you have your information security Twitter account, and I saw you posted a couple of things this week. On one of them, I noticed, which, you know, there are very many customers of Bank of America, and we had a phishing attempt with Bank of America here.
Right, and we do see that one. I think it's cycled every quarter. It's saying that there's a problem with your account. You need to log in. Again, it's a classic phishing email. It has their brand, their color scheme, you know, their names. The link will sometimes, you know, the link is their link. Of course, it takes you somewhere else. You know, and we tweet that out. And this one was we've really gotten more active in Twitter, and this one was very interesting because we did tweet it out and we did do hashtag Bank of America,
BOA,
and Bank of America actually contacted us Twitter saying, that's please forward us this email.
Yes.
Because something like this, they get very...
gets very serious very
serious,
quick.
And you know, they give it a good term and they call it web forgery.
Yeah.
It's a forgery of their services,
right.
and their
image. Their brand and the damage that can occur.
Yeah.
And
oh,
then,
heck, the reputation. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and that's something we kind of have adapted to since we, been really trying to push phishing, is that, you know, we say phishing to a common person and they're kind of like, what's phishing?
Yeah.
I don't get it. But if we tell them it's a forgery, they kind of understand that that's bad.
Yeah.
More than phishing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It gives it that regular term.
I thought I had a message that was somebody up to no good about my mailbox, and you know, was like, okay, this is a scam, this isn't real, and then I'm looking at
like
it,
like a quota limit or something,
right? And that, but then I looked and it turned out I had been out of town. My messages I had deleted on my phone, all of the trash, all of those emails were still on my server or whatever at the university. Mm-hmm. And so I'd been doing, apparently, all of them all along, and I haven't paid attention to that, but it jumped up a lot while I was gone, and looked at it, and it was legitimate. And so I assume it was legitimate because I really did, and I went in and deleted all those old emails.
Even if it wasn't or wasn't legitimate, you didn't click on any link.
You
logged into the normal website that you know is an authentic website, right, and went in and checked it out that way. Where they try to trick you is it's click this link and this takes you to some rogue site.
Okay. So yeah. So if you're going to fact check, don't fact check through them.
Absolutely.
Fact
not.
Check.
And
fact
that's
check.
What. And that's what your tweet said about Bank of America. You know, they will never provide a link to click.
Right.
You know, to click on. So, okay, do you want to share the Twitter account?
Yes.
Because we're getting, I've been retweeting those out, and it's not really just for, EIU folks, because, phishing is a common problem, whether a university or regular business, just regular individual.
Yeah, and, we do these lessons in phishing where we'll take the phishing emails that we get and actually mark them up and point out the issues that identifies that they're phishing.
So you're using it as an education piece.
And then we post it to Twitter. And we've gotten worldwide following and retweets from that. A lot of people in Germany and stuff will start to, India likes to retweet those, and so it's pretty nice to get that worldwide brand. But our Twitter name is EIU_InfoSec.
Okay, we'll put a link to the show notes for that too. So, okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
My technology pick of the week this week is a new magic technology I've been playing around with called Miracast. I've been working over the past 10 months or so on finding a solution to wirelessly display whatever's on my tablet to the big screen. So we've had some success here in the last 8-10 months, and we've also had some trials and tribulations where some things haven't worked quite as advertised, but we're working through some of those issues, and I've got it working pretty well on the Surface Pro, the original Surface Pro tablet, and this requires something called a Miracast receiver that you plug into the back of a TV or a projector. It has to have a HDMI port. So what it allows you to do is wirelessly project whatever's on your screen up to a projector or to an HDTV. That allows the teacher to walk freely about the room. We're not tied to the podium anymore. Walk around, hand the tablet off to a student, and everybody could see that work up on the big screen. So it's kind of a neat technology. It works both with video and audio. So I'll provide a link in the show notes. I've got a couple of blog posts and a couple of YouTube videos out there of some of the different connections and things. And as I said, this is kind of a nascent technology. It works on the newer PCs. You have to have the right combination of CPU and wireless chipset. So some of the older technology won't work. Just depends upon that combination. So I share a couple of the Miracast receivers that we've been using and explain some of the issues that we've been having. And a lot of this is a result of updating your firmware to get the most recent because it is so new.
And you've used this on a TV, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't have to be something that, a scoreboard at a ball game or something like
no,
that
no.
that you're doing. I mean, or a projection device. It can be in a you know, in a smaller room, mm-hmm. but you still want to share it with everybody. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a nice option to have. Yeah.
It's kind of like some people have with iPads and the Apple TV. You know, mm-hmm. an Apple TV is kind of that receiver box on the back end. Yeah. All that requires, you know, your wireless network. Miracast is a little bit more generic, so it's trying to become the standard out there for this wireless transmission. And what's great about that is it doesn't matter if you have a Lenovo or a Toshiba or, you know, a Surface mm-hmm. Pro, whatever. If we can get together on these standards, we can buy that one receiver box and have multiple devices use it. You know,
but not at the same time.
Not at the same time. It's a one-to-one. So you project, and then if you want to have somebody else, you'd have to disconnect it and then have the next person reconnect. But in a classroom setting, it's very nice. Yeah. The range is about 50 to 75 feet in our experience, so which is plenty for a regular classroom or an auditorium. You know, I showed you a month or so ago, we hooked it up to that HDMI projector, so...
Yeah, and both projecting what was on the screen and then live video around the room that you were doing with the camera at the same time was cool.
Mm-hmm. And the newer HDTVs come in with a built-in, many of them do, with a built-in Miracast receiver. But I have the older TVs, so you have to buy this external box right now. It's about $50, $60 for the different ones. But what's nice about that is it's a very small, you know, it's very compact. There is a little bit of latency. It's not really meant for like HD movies or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Is great for like the PowerPoints, and it'll work okay depending upon your wireless for YouTube videos and things. But sometimes there's some, you know, for people talking, lip sync issues. But it's starting to show some promise, and you know, like any other technology, hopefully it'll get better as we go along. So that's my pick. I'll provide a link in the show notes out there for those links.
Very cool.
All right, Cindy, what do you have?
Well, we have two historic events this week that we're seeing a lot of information about, and today is the anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. And so the Library of Congress has provided a couple different ways to get information about that, as have, you know, a lot of the news channels and everything as well. And that, but one that we talked about was the Today in History, mm-hmm. and that, you know, has little snippets to entice, I guess, or hooks for students to get them to really want to learn more, to encourage them to want to learn more. And so it's a great introduction tool. Cool thing about the Today in History on the library site, you can put in any date, so you can put in your birthday, students can put in, you know, whatever, and see what sort of historic events have happened at that time. In addition, the library has an exhibit that they had that one time was an actual exhibit you could walk through, but now they've digitized, and you can find that on their website with background information and documents and all kinds of cool stuff like that. The other one that we're hearing a lot about now is the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, it's the 50th anniversary of that.
And what the discussions they're having about that have really connect with technology today, because we're seeing how they're analyzing these photos and the technology that we have today on the streets as opposed to what they had then. And one lady actually this morning had her Polaroid camera that she had taken a picture with, and they had tried to enlarge it and see some things in the background, mm-hmm. and could only do so much. And it's like, wow, you know, the difference between that and cameras just, today.
Yeah, with the Gettysburg 150 years ago today, and I saw some examples. If you go out, we'll provide some links in the show notes, but the picture, the quote-unquote rare photograph of Lincoln at Gettysburg,
yes.
and they like circled.
Yeah.
So some of those things that are discovered, and they're still finding, you know, new media. I saw, you know, this week, again, it's all in the news, but they're still finding, you know, source material from, you know, the Kennedy assassination with people with pictures and cameras that they tucked away.
Well, and that's interesting because, I mean, the Civil War was... Photographs were a real big thing because it was very new back then, and it showed the harshness of war and everything. And then we talk about the Kennedy's assassination, and now we're using that old tech and trying to use new tech to discover more information about that from where we are now. So I just think it's interesting that again, there's this, you know, the conspiracy relation between mm-hmm. the two,
right. but the and two then events. But also, you know, at that time a Polaroid was cutting edge.
Oh, yeah.
A Polaroid camera.
Instant
and
pictures.
And how now that seems so archaic, you know, and it's like, wow, we look at it.
I saw film the other day. I was like, wow, they still sell this stuff?
Film, yeah, exactly.
Why is it so expensive?
And so, you know, from 150 years to 50 years ago to today, and just the changes that we see. And then I had mentioned, I saw there was going to be a story about, you know, if Oswald had a laptop, what would we know?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, things like that, that information was disposed of much easier. Right. Back then than it is now.
And all the digital footprints and things that are people are leaving behind now. So, yeah, it's quite an evolution going through. And I believe I saw, didn't they put the Gettysburg Address, don't they have the actual handwritten notes of Lincoln up in the Springfield Museum now?
Did they display that? They had an exhibit that you could, there are a couple of different versions of it, and so they had one there.
So yeah, if you're here in Illinois, or you know, outside the state for that matter, there's a wonderful museum in Springfield that you, if you're ever in the area, that you need to check out if you have any interest at all in Lincoln or the Civil War. So,
and it's fairly new. It's only been open less than 10 years now. And so there's a lot of cutting edge technology that they've used in that museum as well. It's a little different than a lot of the older presidential libraries and museums. So that's pretty neat to have within driving range.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mike, what do you have?
I want to, with the recent tornadoes we had here in Illinois, and then also
the major outbreak this week.
It was some communities rough devastated. Day Sunday.
Yeah. And then, of course, the major typhoon in the Philippines and the seriousness, you know, is, you know, I don't know if you want to call it good or great about the human is that we always want to give to those in need. And of course, donations is always something that people want to do. Of course, when there's people that want to give money, there's always people that want to take your money and that aren't for legitimate reasons.
Right.
So, you know, scammers come out in force and they try even harder during these times when people are desperate and actually need help. So, you know, I tweeted it yesterday, you know, to protect yourself if you're going to provide donations. And, you know, it's holiday season too. So we see donations go up also for food and for people that are in need during the holiday season. But just be mindful of where you're donating. You know, charitynavigator.org has some, you know, you just search how to donate, you know, safely. Charitynavigator.org has protecting yourself from online scams when you want to donate. You know, again, it's the same kind of whole phishing aspect.
Yeah, you just want to make sure the organization's legitimate and it's going to the people in need.
Right, because I think during Hurricane Sandy last year, there was actually a lady in New York City that they arrested and charged with fraud for she was accepting donations monetary donations.
And actually, after Sandy Hook, there was a woman that did the same thing after the Sandy Hook shooting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just be, again, be mindful. You know, it's great that people want to help, but you just have to protect yourself because...
Yeah, you want to make sure that money gets where it's, you know, needed. That wraps it up for episode 159 of Tech Talk for Teachers. Show notes for this episode and archived episodes are available on the web at the EIU Instructional Technology Center website at eiu.edu/ITC. To leave a comment or suggestion, please send an email to techtalk@eiu.edu or leave a comment on the Tech Talk for Teachers blog. Until next time, this is Tom Grissom.
Cindy Rich.
Mike Joya.
Keep on learning.